Now, in the very first sermon of this series, I really emphasized back there in the early summer that this book of Revelation is about revelation. It's not about concealment. The purpose of the book isn't to mystify us. The purpose of the book is to enlighten us. But I suspect that as you sat there this morning while I read this chapter, you weren't thinking to yourselves, wow, this is so enlightening. You were probably thinking to yourselves something like, wow, this is absolutely bonkers. This confusing mess of locusts and angels and horses and all the rest of it. How on earth are we to negotiate a path through this bewildering territory? Well, of course, negotiating such a path is what we must try to do this morning. And I guess an obvious place to begin, the first tiny step that we must make, is recognizing some structure in the chapter. And the key verses for that are verses 1 and 13. Verse 1, we read that the fifth angel blew his trumpet. And then verse 13, we read that the sixth angel blew his trumpet. So in other words, this chapter is structured around two trumpets. One designated trumpet number 5 and the other designated trumpet number 6. Now that detail, I know, doesn't suddenly make everything fall into place. There's still an awful lot of work to be done. But it does at least provide us then with a starting point. And on the basis of that structural observation then, I'm going to propose two headings for our sermon this morning: the meaning of these trumpets and the lessons of these trumpets. So first of all then, this morning, the meaning of these trumpets. Well, if you were here last week, you'll appreciate that these two trumpets here in chapter 9 belong to a sequence of trumpets. So trumpets 1 to 4 are in chapter 8 that we considered last Sunday morning. These two, as I've already mentioned, are trumpets 5 and 6, and then there will be a seventh and final trumpet that will feature a little bit later on. And we established then last week, didn't we, that these seven trumpets, they represent God's judgments against unbelievers now, in this present age. We know, don't we, that there is going to be a definitive day of judgment at the end of time, and Revelation at points talks about that. But what these trumpets are teaching us is that God actually sends judgments against unbelievers even now in this present age, and these then are, if you like, an anticipation of that great final judgment on the last day. Remember, we mentioned at the end last Sunday morning that the whole structure here is really, I think, an echo of the well-known Jericho narrative there in the book of Joshua in the Old Testament. And there you remember God's judgment against that wicked city of Jericho. It was to take place, wasn't it, on a definitive day. There was going to be one day when the trumpet would blast and the walls would collapse and that city would come decisively under God's judgment. But at the same time, there was also a process involved in the whole thing, wasn't there? Prior to that seventh day of judgments, there were 6 days when the Israelites marched around the city blowing trumpets. And that then is the picture that we are given, I think, in Revelation 8 and 9. That prior to the decisive judgment on the last day, there's already this process of judgment taking place. God is already, in these days, directing his judgments against unbelieving men and women. And we explored then last week a little bit of the nature of these present judgments which God directs against this world. And we saw then that one aspect of God's present judgment is this very solemn business of God, as I put it last week, entrenching people's idols. That is, God actually deepening the allegiance of men and women to their idols. Now, that's a very striking concept, isn't it? And I suppose if it simply rested on the highly pictorial language of Revelation 8, then we might be sceptical of it, and we might say, well, perhaps we've reached a wrong conclusion about Revelation 8. But that concept of God actually entrenching people in their idolatry, it doesn't rest simply on the pictorial language of the book of Revelation, does it? We have it in Psalm 81, actually, that we read just there, that we sang from just there. Psalm 81, verse 12. God says, "So I gave them up to follow what their stubborn hearts desired." You see there, God just giving people over to their own sinful choices. We have it, I suppose, most famously in Romans 1, don't we? Where Paul at length talks about God in punishment now, in this present age, giving people over to their sinful choices. A very striking verse where it comes across again is 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 11. Paul there is talking about those who refuse to love the truth and be saved. And he says this about them: because they refuse to love the truth and be saved, God sends them a strong delusion so that they may believe what is false. It may not be a theme that we think about very often, or a theme that we particularly like to think about very often, but I'm saying it's clearly there within our scriptures that God, as a judgment now against unbelievers, actually deepens their allegiance to their idols. And trumpets 5 and 6 then, that we're looking at this morning, they really develop that concept. And I suppose the major new element then, which they introduce into this concept, is this: that in order to achieve this effect of entrenching unbelievers' idols, deepening their allegiance to their idols, God uses evil supernatural powers. God uses evil supernatural powers in order to bring this about that we were talking about at the end of last week, in order to kind of deepen people's commitment to their idols. So let's look a bit more closely at our text then. And I suppose perhaps the first very obvious thing, or one of the first very obvious things that strikes you about this chapter, is the sheer number of its participants. And that, of course, adds to this sense of bewilderment that we have when we read it. So we have this star, don't we, in verses 1 and 2. This star fallen from heaven. And that's clearly not just a star, not just an inanimate object, it's a person, because personal words are used of it. In verse 2, the star is referred to as he. So the star is a person. So that's one participant in our scene. And then in verses 3 to 10, we have these locusts described at great length. And then in verse 11, we have a reference to the locusts' king. The king over the locusts. And then in verses 14 and 15, we have four angels referred to. And then in verses 16 to 19, we have these innumerable horse-riding troops. And so there are all these different participants. And I want to suggest to you then that all of these are evil supernatural powers. So let's look at them a bit more closely. The star, first of all, fallen from heaven, that is pretty clearly Satan. We know that from other passages, famously from Jesus' words. Remember Jesus talking to his disciples in Luke 10, verse 18, and he says there, "I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven." Or you just move a couple of chapters on from our passage here to Revelation 12 and verse 9. Where Satan is being talked about, he's being pictured there as a dragon, but we read that the great dragon was thrown down. And then just in case we're not sure who this dragon is, that ancient serpent who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. So it's pretty clear there that the one thrown down from heaven is Satan. So that's the identity of the star. What about the locusts? Well, I think the locusts are then Satan's angels. We have that phrase, don't we, in scripture sometimes? Think of Jesus talking about the devil and his angels. In fact, there in Revelation 12, verse 9, we read that he was thrown down to the earth, Satan, and his angels were thrown down with him. So these are those angels that are aligned with Satan. Demons, I think, is another biblical term for them. And again, I think that is borne out by various links. It's interesting, isn't it, that these locusts here in Revelation 9, they're also kind of pictured as scorpions. In verse 3, in verse 5, in verse 10, they are described as being like scorpions. Now, when you go back to Jesus' words there in that passage I mentioned just now, Luke chapter 10, Jesus, remember the 72 that Jesus sent out, they return to him and they say, "Lord, even the demons are subject to us in your name." And Jesus then says, "I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven." And then this, "Behold, I have given you authority to tread on serpents and scorpions." So scorpions there are a picture of the demons that these disciples have the authority to drive out. And so these locusts that are like scorpions in Revelation 9, they are demons, I think, or the devil's angels, whichever kind of terminology you want to use. What about the king over the locusts in verse 11? Well, that, I think, is Satan again. I mean, that makes sense, doesn't it? The idea of Satan kind of being their king, being the demon's king. And it's confirmed in the language that John uses there in verse 11. He says they have as king over them the angel of the bottomless pit. What does he mean by that? Well, he, I think, is meaning the angel who was given the key to the bottomless pit back in verse 1. And that was the star fallen from heaven, Satan. So the king of the locusts there in verse 11 is Satan again. The four angels, who are they? Well, I think, again, they are more of Satan's angels. Perhaps we could conclude they are particularly eminent ones. We know that amongst the unfallen angels, there's a hierarchy, isn't there? There are angels and archangels and so on. And probably amongst the fallen angels, there is a hierarchy as well. And perhaps these four mentioned here are particularly eminent ones. That could be the case. But it's the same sort of thing we're talking about. And then the horse-riding troops in verses 16 to 19, well, I think they're the same as the locusts, and the descriptions really overlap, don't they? So the locusts back in verse 7 were like horses, and so here now they're being pictured as horses instead of as locusts. The locusts back in verse 8 had teeth like lions' teeth, and these horses have heads like lions' heads in verse 17. The locusts and the horses both wear breastplates. They both have powerful tails and so on. There's all this overlap going on. So the horses are just another picture for the locusts. And so it's demons again that we're talking about. And so I hope you can see then that all these different participants, we're talking about basically the same category. We're talking about evil supernatural powers. And so, to come back then to what the passage is teaching us, it's teaching us this, that God, as a judgment against men and women, deepens them in their allegiance to their idols. And he does so using these evil supernatural powers, especially demons, which seem to be the main powers described in this passage. And so let's just notice then three things about this kind of demonic activity then that's going on here in our passage. First of all, notice then it always involves deception. It always involves deception. That's a real theme here, I think. Notice, to begin with, how these demons, they emerge, don't they, amidst a cloud of smoke in verse 3. From the smoke came locusts on the earth. And smoke then is described as being a kind of darkening thing there in verse 3. The sun and the air were darkened with the smoke. Sorry, verse 2. Smoke has this darkening, obscuring effect. And that then, I think, suggests that there's something underhand, there's something deceptive about these locusts, these demons. Then again, notice that fascinatingly, amidst all their fierce characteristics, their terrible teeth and the noise that they make as they fly and their stinging tails, amidst all these fierce characteristics, there's a couple of more attractive ones, aren't there? In verses 7 and 8, they have faces like human faces. And they have hair like women's hair. And it's a somewhat bizarre and unimaginable picture. But I think it's just making that this point that kind of the fierceness is being disguised. It's a deceptive fierceness. There's an attractiveness about these demons and what they are doing. Then again, this resemblance to scorpions that I've already commented on. And what is it about the scorpion that's being focused on? Well, it's the scorpion's tail, the fact the scorpion stings with its tail. In other words, it stings from behind in a kind of deceptive way. And again, I think that's kind of indicating that these demons, they work through deception. Again, there's an unstraightforwardness about what they're doing. Or then again, the focus on the mouth, verses 17 to 19, that these plagues, they're all coming out of the horses' mouths, mentioned three times in those verses. In other words, these demons, they don't operate by brute force. Rather, they operate by kind of persuasive ideas. Again, it's suggesting deception. And the point is then, I think, that as these unbelievers under God's judgment then in this present age, as they kind of become more and more enthralled with their idols, they don't feel that they are victims of demonic activity. It doesn't feel like that to them. Notice in verses 20 and 21, we have a kind of inventory of idols, don't we? We have reference to idols of gold and silver and bronze and stone and wood, which cannot see or hear or walk. And that then is a little list of kind of traditional religious type idols, isn't it? And then I think in verse 21, we have a kind of list of, if you like, non-religious idols. Murders, sorcery, sexual immorality, theft. So you might say, well, that's a bit of a random list of idols. But I think they stand for things. Murder probably for power. Because murder is trying to assert your power, isn't it? Over someone, taking their life. Sorceries represents knowledge, I think. Wanting to know everything. Sexual morality, sex, thefts, possessions. I think these are four kind of basic human idols. Power, knowledge, sex, possessions. And if we just take the latter, for instance, then, possessions, and you think of their men and women then infatuated with acquiring things, with amassing things, with dreaming about what they are going to get next, and being obsessed with wealth and riches and possessions. I mean, it doesn't seem, we see people like that in our society, don't we? And it doesn't seem to them like they are in the grip of some kind of demonic activity. It seems to them very reasonable. This is what everybody does. This is what you do as a human being. You want the next thing and you aim for it and you do all you can to get it. And you see, they don't realize that behind that lifestyle is an idolatry, and behind that idolatry is this demonic activity that is going on. I'm saying it's deceptive. These demons don't advertise themselves as demons. They don't say to unbelievers, look, we are demons and we're here to get at you. But they do it through these attractive idolatries, these seductive idolatries. There's a deceptive element to the whole thing. So this demonic activity, it always involves deception. Secondly, it often induces despair. It often induces despair. We have that note, don't we, in our passage? Look at verse 5. They were allowed to torment, not to kill, but to torment. And the torment is, that word is repeated several times. And then in verse 6, it's taken even further. People seeking death, even, desiring death. So tormented, so despairing, so anguished, inwardly, emotionally, psychologically, are they? Indeed, even the fact then that these demons are pictured as locusts, and locusts probably doesn't mean much to us, in our situation. But in the ancient world, of course, locusts were a very real threat, and they had one great significance. What did they cause? They caused famine, didn't they? They ate up all the crops. They devoured all the crops, and locusts then were associated with famine. Locusts caused famine. And here then, I think the point is that these aren't literal locusts, and so they don't cause a literal famine, but they cause a different sort of famine, a famine of the soul. We have that actually in the Old Testament. In Amos 8, you can read Amos talking about a famine of the Word of God, a famine of the soul. And it's the picture here then of these demons in the lives of unbelievers as they press their idolatries on unbelievers. It causes unbelievers' souls to shrivel and to sink into despair. Let me quote to you from David Foster Wallace. He was an American novelist, and he committed suicide a few years ago. But prior to that, just a few years before that, he gave a lecture in America at a university, and it was a fascinating lecture. And let me just quote to you David Foster Wallace, not a Christian, and this is what he writes. He says that in the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there's no such thing as atheism. There's no such thing as not worshipping. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. And an outstanding reason for choosing some sort of God or spiritual type thing to worship, be it Jesus Christ or Allah, be it Yahweh or the Wiccan mother goddess or whatever, is that pretty much anything else you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, if they are where you tap real meaning in life, then you'll never have enough. Never feel you have enough. It's the truth. Worship your own body and beauty and sexual allure, and you will always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally plant you. Worship power, you will feel weak and afraid, and you will need ever more power over others to keep the fear at bay. Worship your intellect, being seen as smart, you will end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out, and so on. Very perceptive comments on the nature of idolatry and how it does induce despair. It can't fulfill, it can't keep its promises. It only shrivels souls and causes people to sink into ever-deepening despair. And all Revelation 9 is adding to what that man says, is that behind it are demons that are driving that process. So it always involves deception. It often induces despair. And then thirdly, it can include death. It can include death, because that emphasis is there in verse 15. We have then these angels being released to kill a third of mankind. And in verse 18 again, by these plagues, a third of mankind was killed. That really is the main distinction between trumpet 5 and trumpet 6. They're fairly similar, but in trumpet 6, the whole thing's intensified. In verse 5, the locusts aren't allowed to kill anyone. But now in verse 6, a third of mankind is killed. And I think that's probably pointing to the fact then that these idolatries, they don't just damage souls and induce despair, but they can even drive people to death. In Old Testament times, you had the prophets of Baal cutting themselves with knives, getting into a frenzy. That was a frequent aspect of pagan worship. People would actually kill themselves in the frenzy of pagan rituals. They would kill their children, of course, sacrificing them to their gods. And even today, aren't idolatries sometimes fatal? Even our Western type of idolatries. I read an article in a paper just the other day about people who are workaholics and how these various scientific studies have indicated that it kind of takes years off your life to be a workaholic, to be absolutely obsessed with your work and unable to put it down. A modern idolatry which can even lead its adherents to death. And again, then all Revelation 9 is adding to that article that I read, is that behind this there are demons that are driving this process. And so I hope you get a flavour then of what's going on here with these two trumpets, that this is pointing to God's present judgments against unbelievers. And this particular expression of his judgment, entrenching men and women's idols, but doing so using these demons, they are being used by God to deepen the infatuation that people have with their idols. So that's the meaning. But then as we close, let's just look quickly at the lessons of these trumpets. What does all this mean for us this morning then? Well, two things. First of all, they open our eyes. These two trumpets, they open our eyes. Open our eyes to several things. Open our eyes to the reality then, at the most basic level of this unseen supernatural realm that's all around us. Because I suppose the fact is that when we come to Revelation 9, the form in which it's written, the genre, the type of literature it is, that throws us, doesn't it? And understandably so, we don't read many books that are like this. But it's more than that, isn't it? Even when we have then gone through it and unraveled it and got to its meaning, I suspect that for many of us, even that shocks us. Just the idea then that in this world there are all these demons, there are these supernatural evil powers that are busy doing things in the lives of unbelieving men and women. I mean, that's a bit primitive, isn't it? To really think that in 2014, to think that there are demons around and that they're targeting people who don't believe in the Lord Jesus Christ. But that's what our passage is teaching. And that's what the New Testament often teaches. And it's part, I suppose, of how influenced we have become by our naturalistic age that we find this kind of teaching so troubling. And we criticize the thoroughgoing naturalism of Richard Dawkins and his ilk, but perhaps we've often been influenced by it more than we think ourselves. And perhaps the extent to which we have really comes to the fore when we're dealing with passages like this that talk about demons and the devil and spirits and angels and so on. So it's these trumpets, they're opening our eyes to the reality of an unseen supernatural realm, which is just as real as the seen realm, just as real. Then again, they're opening our eyes to the multifaceted nature of Satan's activity, because of course, before we came to the seven trumpets, we were looking at the seven seals, weren't we? And remember the seven seals, we said, were Satan's attacks on believers. That was the great difference, wasn't it, between the seals and the trumpets. The trumpets are directed at unbelievers. The seals were at believers. Satan's attacks on believers. And so Satan was very much involved there, but he's involved here as well. Now, in this kind of deceiving of unbelievers, he's involved. He's this star fallen from heaven mentioned in verses 1 and 2. And I think sometimes we can be a bit too either-or about Satan. And sometimes we go to one extreme and think that Satan is only interested in attacking unbelievers. Or sometimes we go to another extreme and think that Satan is only interested in attacking believers. What we're told in Revelation is that Satan is involved in both areas. That Satan has his finger in many different pies. And he's involved in attacking believers, and he's also involved in keeping unbelievers infatuated with their idols. And then again, these trumpets, they open our eyes, don't they, to the reason why we encounter such deep-seated rejection of the gospel. Now, we need to be careful here that Revelation, of course, teaches that there is a multitude no man can number from every nation, tribe, people and language that believe in Jesus Christ. And so it's not teaching us that kind of everybody is in the category that we've been talking about today in Revelation 9. And of course, there are many who are in that category for a while and then come to Christ and are no longer in that category. So we must remember that. But nonetheless, we do encounter people, don't we, who are just so deep-seated in their rejection of the gospel and remain like that all their lives. And perhaps many attempts are made to evangelize those people, and yet they never respond. Just a deep-seated rejection to the gospel. Why is that? Well, this passage is telling us, isn't it, that this is why. There are these demonic forces that are holding them back and that are entrenching them in their idolatries. We shouldn't be surprised if at times we encounter very, very deep-seated opposition to the gospel. Revelation 9 is showing us why that is. So these trumpets, they open our eyes. But then, secondly, they comfort our souls. They comfort our souls. How do they do that? Well, two ways. First of all, because they show us that evil supernatural powers are based in the abyss. We should notice that. We haven't touched on that yet. The first two verses of our chapter. We read there that this star fallen from heaven, that's Satan, he was given the key to the shaft of the bottomless pit. Abyss is literally the word that's better. He was given the key to the abyss, and it was then that he was able to kind of open the abyss and let out all these demons. Now you might think, oh, well, that's fine. It just means that kind of all Satan's demons, they kind of live in the abyss. That's just the underworld where they belong. But I don't think that's quite the point. Remember that occasion in the Gospels, Luke 8, and Jesus has delivered that man who's demon-possessed. He's crossed the Sea of Galilee to the region of the Gerasenes. He's delivered that man who is demon-possessed. And remember the demons coming out of the man. They then interestingly plead with Jesus, don't they? Don't send us into the abyss. Same word, don't send us into the abyss. In other words, the abyss is not kind of this nice cozy home where the demons like to live. It's somewhere where they don't want to be. It's somewhere where they are confined but don't want to be. I think that is explained to us in an important verse in 2 Peter, 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 4, where we read, God did not spare angels when they sinned, but cast them into hell and committed them to chains of gloomy darkness to be kept until the judgment. So you see what that is teaching us. It's teaching us that Satan's angels, Satan's demons, they are being confined by God in this place called the abyss, ready for the day of judgment. It's a prison. It's not where they live in some happy way. It's a prison where they are confined until the day of judgment. Now, this Revelation 9 is saying that they can be let out of there in order to be active in this present age. But that's where they're based. That's where they belong. And in fact, Satan only has the key to it because, of course, he's given the key, verse 1. He was given the key. And we've been told in chapter 1 that Jesus has the key of death and Hades. And it's all impressing upon us this point then that we needn't be frightened as Christians by this idea of the world being kind of overrun by demons and so on. They are basically being kept in prison for the day of judgment. And yes, they are given the liberty to engage in a bit of activity now, as we've been seeing this morning, but very much on God's terms. He gives the key, or Christ gives the key to Satan, and then he'll take the key back again, and then he'll give it to Satan again when Satan's allowed to let them out a bit more. And then Satan must return the key again. It's very much on Christ's terms. These demons are imprisoned in the abyss, waiting for the day of judgment. So that should be a comfort to us. It can sound so scary, all this stuff. And yet let's remember what Revelation is teaching us more than it's teaching us anything, that Jesus Christ is in control of everything. And then secondly, it's comforting, these two trumpets. And most importantly of all, I think, because it's teaching us that these evil supernatural powers, they can only operate where a person is not sealed. Did you see that? We haven't touched on it. Verse 4. Only those people who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. And we've already seen in chapter 6 that for Christians, for those who are sealed, there are trials and there are attacks and there are buffetings throughout this life. But this stuff that we're talking about here, demons kind of deceiving and pushing us onto idols, that is confined to those who are not sealed. Those who are sealed are safe from that. Because this is one of God's trumpets. This is a judgment. And we're immune to judgment, aren't we? Because Christ has taken all our judgment. We're immune to the great final judgment. And we're immune to all these premature judgments now. We need to be absolutely clear on that. If we are Christ, we are sealed. And if we are sealed, we are immune to every form of judgment in the future or in the present. Because Christ has exhausted it all for us. So there's a great deal of solemnity in our passage. This fact that unbelievers are judged by God now, and that takes the form of them being wedded more and more to their idols. But there's also great encouragement in this passage that if you're Christ, you are sealed and you are safe and demons cannot touch you, and you are sealed because God loves you so much that he will not risk losing you. And you are sealed so that God will, on the last day, save you fully and take you to be with him forevermore. Amen.